Chapter 7. The Sisterhood. A happy family is but an earlier heaven. George Bernard Shaw. My sisters became my platoon. We were all in a war, fighting for significance. Each of us was a soldier fighting for our value, our worth. We were all in it together. We all needed one another. None of us could fight individually. I know I didn't have enough strength. We were fighting a war with seen and unseen enemies. Regardless, our commitment was to the whole. It was a together or nothing ethos. Eventually, we would separate, and some would be left on the battleground intact, but missing something. But as children, we were in it together. Diane, the oldest, Anita, 1 year behind her, Dolores, 2 years younger, and me, 3 years her junior. We all wanted out, and our bonds of sisterhood helped make a way. Diane was the brains, Anita the brawn, Dolores was the mastermind. Me, I was the one who could either drag the whole team down or up miraculously in the final hour. We were transformed by Miss Tyson. Then winning the drama skit contest shifted our lives because our sister platoon had seen a physical manifestation of winning our war. The bat from the softball set, the red bat we won, became the rat catcher, a tool in our arsenal. Rats always come out of nowhere. You could be sitting in front of the TV watching your show and all of a sudden a rat jumps on the couch. Or one comes scurrying out of a hole in the wall and in a flash is underneath the couch. Whenever we saw a rat, we told Anita, "I saw a rat!" Once she saw the rat, she got the prize we won, that red bat, out. We would all stand behind her, clutching her. Diane said, "It went under! It went under there! Get it! Get it! Get it!" We were all really quiet, waiting for it to slow down. We saw its tail visible under the couch. Anita waited. She, who, by the way, became an all-star softball player, timed it perfectly. Bam! She actually knocked the tail off the rat. She didn't kill the rat. She just knocked its tail off. The prize bat came in handy again when Mama was napping in her bedroom, her mouth open in the middle of the day one weekend. Unafraid of our black cat boots, the biggest freaking rat we have ever seen was on her pillowcase, slowly inching toward her. We snuck out and told Anita, "There's a rat! It's about to kill Mom! Bite Mama's neck!" Anita got the bat, and once again we were behind her, holding on to her, as the rat stealthily inched toward Mama's open mouth. Why we just didn't yell, "Mama, wake up!" to make the rat jump off the bed and run, I don't know. Boots leapt onto the pillow, viciously meowed, and the rat darted into the closet and hid among the crowded clothes. Mama woke startled. "The rat is somewhere in the middle of the clothes," we screamed. Was it in between the coats or hidden in the dresses? We were trying to figure it out, peeking to see its tail from behind Anita, who wielded the red bat. "I think it's right here," she said. "Make sure you get it, Anita, because he's somewhere in the middle of these clothes," we chimed. Anita aimed perfectly. She timed it just like she later hit softballs. And as hard as she could, she brought that red bat down and flattened the rat like a pancake. The great memory of winning the contest, my acting debut that started me on my journey toward becoming an actress, is accompanied by recollections of that red plastic bat and its handiness as a rat killer. Rats are a huge part of that memory of winning. I'm terrified of rats to this day. Our growing up years were speckled with good moments. Happiness for me was Valentine's Day. My father knew how to celebrate Valentine's Day and other major holidays. He bought lots of chocolate, and believe it or not, for Easter, he bought Easter eggs and gave us cards. Christmas, especially when we were younger, was festive, and we would always put up a tree. Once I got to be about 11 or 12, there weren't many gifts. But still, we had a Christmas tree, and my dad was the happy drunk when he would play his guitar. I was 7 or 8 when my dad got us a pool table. It was a full-size pool table. My dad bought it because he liked playing pool at the bar. I loved playing pool. After a while, that pool table was jacked up, and we never had another one. But sometimes we would go to the bar back in the day when parents could take kids to the bar and play darts and pool and be treated to Sprite and potato chips. These happy moments would soon be followed by trauma, the rage of my dad's alcoholic binges, violence, poverty, hunger, and isolation. In my child's mind, I was the problem. I would retreat to the bathroom, put something against the door so no one would come in. And I'd sit for an inordinate amount of time, staring at my fingers and hands, and try to erase everything in my mind. I wished I could elevate out of my body, leave it. One time when I was about 9 years old, I succeeded. I left it. My body, that is, in a manner of speaking. I floated up to the ceiling, looking down at myself, observing my hair, my legs and my face. Then I faced myself, staring directly into me. Wow! I loved it. It was a magical secret power, only I didn't see myself as magical or powerful. I just felt free. It was my way of disappearing. It was my high. I couldn't always control this out-of-body sense, but when I could, it was beyond fabulous. The power to leave my body, to be relieved of Viola for a while, was an ever-present image that followed me for decades. I never liked how it ended, though. These out-of-body experiences would always seem to stop abruptly. I would come crashing down, like in movies where someone had telekinetic powers and would lift an item couldn't concentrate anymore, so the item would come crashing down. I was out of my body and suddenly back in it. I tried to compartmentalize to dodge those heavy emotions until I couldn't. The power was temporary. Even now, me and Dolores have dreams about 128. It created the backdrop for Bonds of Sisterhood. 128 was a womb of sisterhood. At night, we sisters would huddle on a top bunk for warmth, horrified at the sounds of rodents eating pigeons on the roof, eating our toys, squealing, when we felt the weight of their bodies as they jumped on our beds searching for something to eat. We would wrap bedsheets around our necks to protect ourselves from bites. Going to the bathroom at night in the midst of this was not an option. Cutting on the lights and watching them scurry was not an option because there were no lights in the part of the apartment where we slept. The bathroom was a faraway place on the other side of the apartment, but it may as well have been on the other side of the world. If you didn't go before bed, you could forget making that journey at night. So we just peed. We dreamed away our problems. When Dad was drunk or there was turmoil, my sister Dolores and I would disappear into the bedroom and become Zsa Zsa and Zsa Zsi, rich white Beverly Hills matrons with big jewels and little chihuahuas. We would play this game for hours. "Oh, my Zsa Zsa," Zsa Zsi would say. "I bought this fabulous house and my husband bought me this beautiful diamond ring." We played with such detail that it became transcendent. We played with the backdrop noise of our mom being beaten and screaming in pain. But we believed we were in that world until eventually Dolores would break the spell, saying, "You're not Zsa Zsa. You're poor. You're on welfare. You don't have diamonds." We'd fight, and the game of pretend would be over until the next time there was family tumult. It was how we escaped. We transformed into people we felt were better. People who existed in a world we only dreamed of. Women who were not us. We played for fun and out of desperation. Zsa Zsa and Zsa Zsi were our pretend protection. The majority of my most joyful memories were from my relationship with my sisters. We dreamed together so fiercely. We started a band called the Hot Shots. We were trying to be the Jackson Five. We never wrote a song or played an instrument. We had no money to take lessons. But what we lacked in ability, we made up for in drive and imagination. Dolores was on drums. Diane was the lead singer. I played the tambourine, and Anita was on guitar. We could pretend and escape into our imagination. We were fascinated by fireworks. One day we purchased firecrackers. Having the money to do so was a big deal. We bought them from one of the corner stores. For reasons I don't remember, we decided to light a firecracker in the kitchen of 128 and throw it out the window. I was in charge of holding the firecracker. I froze, or as they say in the vernacular, I nutted up. My sister screamed at me to throw it, but I couldn't move. It exploded in my hands. My hands went numb completely. Visualize a Looney Tunes cartoon where I totally lose my hearing and smoke comes out of my nose and ears. Like Wile E. Coyote, I stood with the exploded firecracker in my hand. My mouth gaped open. I saw my sisters mouthing the words because I couldn't hear. Viola, are you okay? Stupid, I told you to throw it. Then my ass started to cry. I'm deaf. Oh my God. My hearing came back. My sisters and I continued to navigate our world. We continued to figure it out on our own in the absence of parents. Our parents were just trying to keep us alive the only way they knew how. They controlled what they could and injected ritual, joy, hope in little ways. For example, we were gifted new clothes at least once a year on Easter. Despite piss beds, almost never having clean clothes, rats jumping on our bed at night, broken furniture, food insecurity, shoddy plumbing, no phone, we all got a brand new outfit. The potency and power of tradition is deep. My mom would break out the hot combs, a metal curling iron and straightening comb that she would put on the stovetop fire. With blue magic pomade, she would proceed to straighten and curl our hair for Easter. It was a sadistic ritual as I saw it. She would slap and yell at us, "Keep your ass still or I'll burn you," if we squirmed. When that hot straightening comb hit that greased piece of hair, sizzled and fell on your ear or face, you had to squirm. Sometimes she'd get to talking and leave the comb and curling iron on the fire too long. Those hotter-than-hot irons would burn the hair black. Keep your ass still! In the end, we looked really cute in our maxi dresses and new shoes. But man, did we look greasy. We didn't care. We loved it. My parents gave us candy, some money, and we would stand in the yard waiting for anyone to pass by so they could see how cute we looked. Finally, Diane came up with the idea of going to church. She said that's what they did down south. The only churches in Central Falls were Catholic. We got up the courage to go since most people we knew in Central Falls were Catholic. We went into Holy Trinity Church and sat in the back. From the moment we stepped into the church, all eyes were on us. I thought everyone was mesmerized by how cute we looked. We pretended or tried to learn the songs and different responses. Then, prompted by Diane, we went up for communion. Just say amen after he puts the bread in your mouth. I was excited about getting the little piece of bread. When time came to take the bread of Christ, the priest leaned down and whispered, "Are you Catholic?" Diane, with her mouth still open, ready, shook her head truthfully. "No." He motioned for us to leave. I then realized why we had been so closely observed. After that, we took our Easter money to Leroy Theater to watch a double feature and eat either hot dogs or large bags of M&Ms, 75 cents for a double feature and 35 cents for a big bag of M&Ms. The other holiday was Halloween. We would be the first ones out trick-or-treating and the last ones home. The goal was to get as much candy as we could. We would fill one bag and go out with another. We never really had costumes, so we would just put my mom's makeup on our nose, forehead, cheeks, and that would be it. There was no money for anything else. One year, we made it a point of going out before it got dark. We ran out with our pillowcases and paper bags. It was the best idea because we were the only kids out. We saw no one else, absolutely no one. We were going to get the best candy because we were the first. We knocked on our first door. It was a father and a mother with about three kids. We screamed, "Trick or treat!" The man looked completely startled and burst out laughing. "Halloween is tomorrow! You all came out on the wrong day!" His wife and kids came to the door and proceeded to laugh hysterically at us. We ran away fast and didn't stop until we got home. Some battles we won, survived together, and emerged with laughter and perspective, and some brutal ones. Sexual abuse, we lost. Sexual abuse back in the day didn't have a name. The abusers were called dirty old men, and the abused were called fast, or heifers. It was shrouded in silence and invisible trauma and shame. It is hard to process how pervasive it was. What made us sitting ducks was our lack of supervision and lack of knowledge. It was a different time. The abuse spanned from random old men on the street telling us, especially me, because I was the youngest, how adorable we were. Then came, "I'll give you a quarter if you give me a kiss." I wanted the quarter. I would take it, give the old man with the can a kiss on the cheek. He would linger there, staring, waiting for something more. I would look around suspiciously until something in me told me to run. A birthday party at a friend's house was crowded with hard-drinking, beer-swilling types. The house had a back porch that led onto the rooftop of their garage. It was a great space to play as kids, which is what we did that day. One of the men at the party would pretend to chase us between drinks. We would run and laugh. He chased us until he just about cornered us, but all the kids managed to duck, dodge around him, except me. I froze, and he grabbed me. All the kids were pointing, laughing at the fact I was caught. He grabbed me and said, "You are so cute and pretty." Then he proceeded to lift my skirt, pull my underwear aside, exposing my butt cheek, and begin to rub, making sexual noises. The children screamed in horror and ran. I squirmed and punched my way out of his arms and ran. The other kids began to tease me. "Ha ha, you got caught. That was nasty." I was absolutely devastated. Making matters worse and even more confusing, I was the one being humiliated. Not the man who felt me up in front of everyone. I was just 8 but felt dirty, spoiled. Even more insidiously painful, I was ashamed at how I felt, not just what happened. Think about that for a minute. Ashamed at myself for feeling violated by a grown-ass perverted violator. I was by myself at that party, alone, left to fend and navigate the shark-infested waters by myself. We were left with older boys, neighbors who would babysit us and unzip their pants while playing horsey with us. My three sisters and I, Danielle wasn't born yet, were often left unsupervised with my brother in our apartment. Sexual curiosity would cross the line. He would chase us, we would lose, and eventually, other inappropriate behavior occurred that had a profound effect. I compartmentalized much of this at the time. I stored it in a place in my psyche that felt safely hidden. By hiding it, I could actually pretend it didn't happen. But it did. Once again, more secrets. Layers upon layers of deep, dark ones. Trauma, shit, piss and mortar mixed with memories that have been filtered, edited for survival, and entangled with generational secrets. Somewhere buried underneath all that waste lived me, the me fighting to breathe, the me wanting so badly to feel alive. But this is the journey. The only weapon I have to blast through it all is forgiveness. It's giving up all hope of a different past. My mom is now 78, and her memory is slowly starting to fade. As I watch her now, I am desperately trying to hold on to every bit of time we have left together. I'm trying to take all the secrets and barriers off the table, any barriers we could possibly have between us. One day, over some green tea and toast, we sat and talked about past memories and my childhood in Central Falls. As we talked, a knot in my stomach bubbled up and showed itself. It's that familiar feeling I get before I do something risky or uncomfortable, like when I'm in social environments where I feel I don't fit in. But this particular time, I push forward anyway. I dug down deep. I harnessed my anger, my hurt, and I told her about a painful memory. Dolores, Anita, Diane, and I were sexually abused, I told her as I uttered my brother's name in that same breath. He chased us in the apartment. He was aggressive. We were scared. We were so young, Mom. There was penetration with Anita and Diane. Me and Dolores were touched. There was silence. She didn't move. It's ironic that she was sitting in my beautiful kitchen of marble and porcelain with the Sub-Zero refrigerator and high ceilings, and it meant absolutely fucking nothing compared to the largeness of the truth of what was happening. Success pales in comparison to healing. Not just the truth of the abuse, but the decision to love, to forgive, what I knew the reaction would be, which was silence. Silence. Heavy silence. The silence that steeped in shock, hurt, guilt, recognition of her own abuse. The silent desperation of trying to negotiate the complexity of being a mother. The only sign that something had shifted in her was her uneaten toast. There were other kinds of incidents we experienced as a sisterhood. We were trying to make sugar candy on the stove while my parents were out, either at the local bar, though my mom never drank, or my mom was at bingo and my dad at work. Sugar candy was a country tradition that my sister Diane taught us. You pour an insanely inappropriate amount of grease in an iron pan and pour enough sugar to give an entire school full of children diabetes in it and just stir over a high flame. It would caramelize. You then turn the heat off and let it cool and harden into sugar candy. We would try anything involving food. We were always, always hungry. One time we let the grease cook too long and it popped out and splattered all over Anita's face. She screamed, we screamed, Diane got a greasy rag and wiped. A layer of skin came off. She grabbed her coat and ran out to get my mom. Anita ended up in the emergency room and had big blisters on her face. Our silent competition about who wet the bed the most and who would end up stopping first. My brother playing Bruce Lee through a butcher knife at my sister Anita. Miraculously, it missed her organs and embedded itself in her leg instead. My parents started fighting while my mom was doing Diane's hair. My father got so mad and out of control, he threw a glass at my mom, which hit Diane in the head, splitting her head open. Blood gushed out. When I look back at what I've seen, my only thoughts are that it's amazing how much a human body can endure. There are not enough pages to mention the fights. The constantly being awakened in the middle of the night or coming home after school to my dad's rages and praying he wouldn't lose so much control that he would kill my mom. Sometimes her head or arm would be split open. She would have a swollen face, split lip. I was always afraid when he picked anything up like a piece of wood because he would hit her as hard as he could and keep beating, sometimes all night. There were so many times that we would see droplets of blood leading to our apartment, and we just knew what was happening. It was chaos, violence, anger, and poverty mixed with shame. One night, my father came home profoundly drunk. He kept saying, "Man, Alice, I'm dying. I'm not going to live past the night. Wake up the children." My mom crying woke us all up. We were exhausted and just sat in their room trying not to fall asleep. My dad was on the floor, wasted and periodically throwing up clear liquid. My mom was holding his head, crying. "Y'all, your dad is dying," he moaned. "I ain't gonna be here much longer. I want to say bye to you, all of y'all." I started crying. I was a crybaby. My sisters were stoic. My dad began to say goodbye to each of us. "Dolores, you smart. You gonna do good, but you gotta stop stealing your sister's shit and selling it at school. Don't think I don't know what you're doing." Dolores then started crying. A little. "Diane, you take care of your sisters. Vala, you my baby. You know your daddy loves you. But your ass needs to stop pissing in the bed and stinking up the house. Nita, I don't know what the hell to do with you. You piss in the bed, steal, fight people. Ugh." He convulsed, threw up, and went cold. Stopped moving. I wailed, "Daddy! No, don't die, Daddy!" Then he woke right back up. "I love y'all." My mom looked at us and said, "Y'all go back to bed." There were continual battles. After every one of them, there was a looming reality. How will we overcome this one? The only hope was that these ever-present battles would be little traumas, not a big trauma. In the early 70s, my sister Anita came face to face with a big one. It started out as a normal, uneventful summer day. And my family and our next-door neighbors, the Owens, were all sitting on the porch talking. Now, this was at 128. The Owens had the apartment that we eventually would occupy once they moved out. They were a large family, just like ours. We were very close and would just play together all the time. As the adults enjoyed the calm of the porch, we kids were running inside the house, periodically ducking our heads outside. While we young'uns frolicked without a care in the world, Mrs. Owens and my mom suddenly blurted, "Look at that monster! Oh my God, what is he doing?" Of course, we ran outside to see. "Look, he ran into the backyard!" we exclaimed with excitement, absolutely unaware of where this seemingly innocent ride would later take us. As we ran to see the monster in the backyard, our parents screamed behind us, "Don't you go near that man!" We saw him, a man in the middle of the backyard with no shoes on, jeans that were torn at the leg, and a shirt that was haphazardly buttoned. He just stood, rocking back and forth, and groaning. His eyes didn't register us at all, even though he was looking straight at us. Our parents weren't joking. If he wasn't a monster, he would certainly do until a real one came along. We screamed at him, "Look at us! Woohoo! Look, monster, we're here!" We were terrified, but playing it off brilliantly in our minds with our rude taunts. Suddenly, a stray cat we had unofficially adopted came walking over to this man. We screamed, "Cat!" We hadn't named the damn cat yet. "Cat, get away from him!" We screamed at the top of our lungs, hoping to startle the cat enough for it to run away. We certainly didn't have the guts to run near the monster and get it, so we just kept screaming at the cat and to the man not to pick up our kind of pet. Suddenly, the rocking entity that looked every bit the part of horror movie villain picked the cat up by the back of its neck. Our screams got louder. If he heard us, we couldn't tell because he didn't respond to us. Instead, he looked at the cat, stroked it almost lovingly, and then calmly broke its neck. Blood oozed out of the dead feline's mouth. Its head hung, although it seemed like it was still trying to live. The man held the bloody cat up, let its blood drip down his face, and licked it. He flung the cat down and smeared the blood on his face ritualistically like war paint. We were absolutely still, not believing what we were seeing, traumatized. Suddenly, like a switch turned on, he finally registered us, his childish tormentors, growled and charged at us full speed. We ran inside our apartment building like hunted animals, clawing over each other, scrambling, crying. We made it up the stairs. When we looked around, out of breath, crying, we discovered Anita wasn't there. We called the police. My dad ran around the city looking for her. We cried. Meanwhile, unbeknownst to us, Anita was being hunted. She later told us as we, her sisters and friends, ran to the apartment, she went in another direction. And soon the monster saw her and began his hunt. Anita shared how she was running, hiding behind trees, the huge rock at Jenks Park. She tried being quiet to not give away her positions, but he was hunting her as if he was in a war. And everywhere she hid served only as a temporary safe haven until he again spotted her and continued the chase. While my sister was literally running for her life, we had no idea where she was. The cops came to our home, but they didn't know either. Then we saw her running down Washington Street from Jenks Park. She was out of breath, crying hysterically. She ran into the market across the street from our house, the bloodied monster right behind her. The butcher from the Columbian Market came out with a machete and screamed, "You stop!" Miraculously, this real-life Friday the 13th Jason stopped, frozen, limp. He then put his head down as if someone took a battery out of him. We watched the cops put a straitjacket on him and put him on a gurney and into a padded wagon. We later found out that he had just come back from Vietnam, where he spent months in the woods eating all kinds of rodents and cats. His PTSD was so bad that his wife had thrown him out of the house that day. Anita was always the brawn in the family, the survivor, the fighter. But even some of the mightiest of warriors have wounds that leave them debilitated. This incident threatened to leave Anita feeling depleted. The blood on the floor that belonged to my mom, or blood on the streets from the damaged souls that we encountered, needed mounds of salve. And we didn't have the knowledge or the tools to grasp that. We just didn't. Chapter 8. Secret, Silent Shame. The invisibility of the 1-2 punch that is blackness and poverty is brutal. School was our salvation. We coped by excelling academically. We loved learning. We didn't want to end up in the same situation as our parents, worrying where the next meal was coming from. School was also our haven. We stayed late, participating in sports, music, drama, and student government. My sisters and I became overachievers, even in areas that didn't interest us. Dolores and Diane made the Rhode Island and National Honor Society. They blazed a path for me. But at school, I was always so sleepy, hungry, and ashamed. I would arrive to school at 8 a.m., and by 8:30, I was falling asleep. For many years, I had problems sleeping through the night. I never slept through the night. At best, I slept periodically, wearily, because it was during the middle of the night that a lot of my parents' fights happened. If I got 2 hours of sleep, I was lucky. We'd be awakened by a scream, a screech. The only hope, the only blessing, was a fight that didn't last long. But sometimes their conflicts would last all night or night after night for days. If it lasted all night, we did not sleep. Imagine your father beating your mom with a 2x4 piece of wood, slamming it on her back. The screams for help, the screams of anger and rage. That trauma would keep me up at night and make me fall asleep in class. I wet the bed until I was 14. I'd often go to school smelling. Having no hot water sure didn't help. Try washing up with ice-cold water and rarely any soap in the dead of winter. We chose between laundry detergent, soap, or dishwashing liquid. Usually we substituted one for the other based on our needs. Hauling bags of laundry a mile or two in freezing temperatures with ice and snow was no picnic, and having the quarters for laundry was a luxury. So usually, the night before, we washed our clothes by hand in cold water and soap and hung them to dry. We would hang wet clothes over doors or a chair because a clothesline would be exposed to snow, rain, or freezing cold air that would make the clothes turn to ice. The next day, they were almost never dry, but we had no choice. We would put on wet clothes and they would dry as we went through our day. I reeked of urine. My sister Dolores and I went to Cowden Street School when I was in fourth grade and she in fifth. Dolores absolutely loved school. She was that student who came home excited if she had a test coming up. She was also a voracious reader. Before she entered sixth grade, she was consuming books like Wuthering Heights and those by Agatha Christie. And unlike me, she never got in trouble in school as she was very respectful of teachers. Well, one day, Dolores came home excited about a science test. It's all she would talk about for a week. At this point, she wanted to be an archaeologist. On the day of her big science test, something different was happening in class for me. My teacher, who I loved, kept staring at me. Whenever I moved closer to her to answer questions, she would step back. Then I saw her talking to the teacher next door. Only a door separated the classes, so they would talk in the doorway. On this day, they whispered and looked at me. Finally, when we got in a circle to read, I ran to sit next to her, and she leaned back with a distressed look on her face. She then gestured for me and whispered in my ear, "You need to tell your mother to get some soap and water and wash you. The odor is horrible." Then she shooed me away as if I had vomited on her. I was numb. A few minutes later, I was called to the nurse's office. When I walked in, I saw Dolores. The nurse hadn't arrived yet. Dolores was sitting in a chair in front of the nurse's desk, and she was catatonic. She obviously was called in for the same reason. I whispered, "Dolores, oh my God, can you believe?" But I never finished because she told me to shut up and she put her head down again. The nurse came in and gave a whole lecture of the complaints from teachers about our hygiene. She asked how we washed up. We said nothing. We were trained in the art of keeping secrets, and we never, ever shared with anyone what went on in our home. Ever. She then proceeded to tell us how you should never wear the same underwear twice, how to wash up, how to use soap, and what areas to wash first. Then we went home. Many decades later, I brought up that day to Dolores and she told me her memories of that day. She said she had taken her science test and gotten an A. She was beyond excited and took her paper back to her desk. She was being incessantly bullied by a girl named Maxine. Maxine looked at my sister's test and went up to the teacher and said, "Miss, Dolores cheated." And without missing a beat, the teacher called Dolores up to her desk, took her test from her, and put a big red F on it. She was devastated. But she said this was a teacher who simply never liked her because she always got straight A's. She was the same teacher who told me in second grade that black people could not read or write at all when they were slaves. I told Dolores I was sorry that happened to her and we didn't help her. She said, "That's okay, Viola." That was the day I decided to be a teacher. It devastated me so much that I didn't want another kid to go through what I went through. Dolores has been a brilliant teacher for the past 35 years. It's funny that with the complaints about hygiene, no one ever asked us about our home environment. No one asked us if we were okay or if anything was wrong. No one talked to us. There was a lack of intentional investment in us little black girls. A few people would drop what they called useful affirmations like work hard, stay in school and do good, be great, behave and don't get into trouble. There was an expectation of perfectionism without the knowledge of emotional well-being. What it left in me was confusion. How do I get to the mountaintop without legs? But we constantly push it with kids now, and when you're a poor kid growing up with trauma, no one is equipping you with tools to do better, to make a life. It's funny that I loved my fourth grade teacher so much and wanted her to love me with the same intensity. As traumatizing as it was to be told I smelled, it was worse feeling the shame. It was so overwhelming that I went home and did everything the nurse said. I washed my underwear, clothes, scrubbed my privacy and underarms. It gave me such a sense of pride to go back to school the next day clean. I sat in class with a huge smile and waited to be acknowledged for the change. But I wasn't. None of the teachers who complained ever really noticed us at all after that. You're expected to be clean, not celebrated. The invisibility of the 1-2 punch that is blackness and poverty is brutal. Mix that with being hungry all the damn time and it becomes combustible. If you're hungry, you can't focus. You have no energy. School lunch was our stable, assured meal. The food stamps our family received the first of each month paid for a grocery run. But the food soon ran out. When it was gone, my sisters and I mooched off the families of friends and dumpster dived, rummaging through garbage for food. I would befriend kids whose mothers cooked 3 meals a day and go to their homes when I could. One time a friend came over to our house and when she opened the refrigerator and saw there was nothing in it, asked, "Are you guys moving?" I shoplifted food. I was 9 the last time I stole food from a store. That day I was caught slipping a brownie down the front of my pants, but I never got it out of the store because the owner screamed at me, looking at me like I was nothing. "Get out, go away, and never come back." The shame forced me to stop. The experience of going to bed hungry is something that neither my sisters nor I will ever forget. I messed up all the time. I hid my feelings, my anger and pain. Or I lashed out and got into fights. Detention every day, back talk with teachers. I pushed a teacher once. I wanted attention really bad. I didn't know the butterflies that were ever present in the pit of my gut were actually massive anxiety. I felt I just didn't fit in. I was a whirling dervish of complexity and emotions. The true me was so trapped inside like that demon inside of Reagan in the movie The Exorcist. When Reagan is tied to the bed to keep from harming herself and her body is racked by scars from this powerful demon, her mom's secretary comes barging in the room and as clear as day, slowly but deliberately, the words, "Help me," form on her belly. The sweet, kind, authentic, precocious Reagan fighting to be released is still alive. Well, that's what I felt like. Imprisoned and possessed by outside forces that were way more powerful than me. No one wanted to drink from the bubbler after me. Bubbler or bubbler was the Rhode Island term for water fountain. My classmates would always wait for the teacher to turn her head and whisper, "Yuck, I'm not drinking after that, nigga. You're dirty." This would both shut me down and anger me. One day, I tried to rip the pretty yellow dress off Maria, a Portuguese girl who used the word nigga with impunity. My teacher punished me. I tried to explain, but she said there was no explanation. This was a teacher I loved, for whom I stayed after school once and volunteered to clean the chalkboard. She was young and pretty. I felt she liked me. This, unfortunately, was an illusion. I created a phantom to survive. We watched an American history film strip that day that had a blurb about slavery with pictures of black people in slave quarters down south. Everyone laughed when the images came up and the voiceover said, "Black people or slaves at this time were illiterate. That means they couldn't read or write." The kids laughed and whispered, "You niggas can't do anything." I stayed after class to ask my teacher one question. Despite being a troublemaker, despite pushing her once by accident, I was terrified as I waited until everyone was gone and quietly cleaned the entire chalkboard. She thanked me, and as I was leaving, I got up the courage to ask, "Miss, it's not true, is it? Black people could read and write. They could, couldn't they?" She shook her head sadly and said, "No, I'm sorry, honey. They couldn't." I left with my head down. She never explained to me or to the class that it was illegal during slavery to teach the enslaved to read and write. It was a way to keep them subjugated. I was looking for something or someone to define me, to infuse in me self-love, acceptance, to show me how to live, to show me I was all right. I held on to what I had, all that I had, the team effort with my older sisters. That preserved me. We were a girl posse, fighting, clawing our way out of the invisibility of poverty and a world where we didn't fit in. The world was our enemy. We were survivors. Until another squad member was introduced. She needed protection that we had no weaponry for. Chapter 9. The Muse. "Y'all meet your baby sister." Mae Alice Davis. When I was 11, another girl was added to our family, Danielle. We didn't have a phone, so when my mom went to the hospital in labor the night before Danielle was born, they said they would call the fire department once the baby was born. The next morning, my father made us wake up early and clean the house from top to bottom. It was his way of contributing and working out his nerves. We swept, wiped. Finally, a young man came running up the hill, out of breath, with a piece of paper. It read, "Congratulations, a 7-pound, 6-ounce baby was born this morning." We were so excited. We screamed and jumped up and down. It was a moment tattooed in my mind as pure, unbridled joy. My father told us to get dressed and we started our long walk to the hospital. It took us hours because we had no money for bus fare, but man, we were fueled by excitement. We walked single file on the side of the road at times, on the sidewalk at other times. We finally made it to the hospital after a 2-hour trek, walked into the room and saw my mom. She was lying down with a blanket over our baby. I remember her words precisely. "Y'all meet your baby sister." She pulled the blanket away and revealed the most beautiful baby. Chocolate brown with the biggest afro. We cried, melted with love. I was the baby of the family before this time, but now I had a role of big sister. A type of transformation began to take place. At the time, I had no words to describe the shift to loving someone more than myself, seeing beyond myself. Words cannot explain our closeness. We did absolutely everything together. I never wanted to leave her, ever. It was as if life was injected into our lives. I changed diapers, put her to sleep, babysat, gave her medicine when she was sick, and held her tight when my parents fought. She was our cub, and we accepted her into the pride. I was 11 and had already had my period for a year, but was by no means grown. I had attitude for days. When I was at home, that attitude stopped cold. I was too terrified of my father, but at school, I was out of control. Always talking out and back, my teachers sought every day to find ways to keep me still and quiet. I would get white and pink disciplinary slips. Pink was the worst. You get 3 pink slips, then you're suspended. I had 3 white and 2 pink. I would forge my dad's signature or get my sister to do it. It was a good thing we didn't have a phone, or that would have been my ass. I was unsettled. I was an awkward, angry, hurt, traumatized kid. I couldn't articulate what I was feeling, and nobody asked. I didn't believe anybody cared. I was saturated in shame. There was so much we didn't have or couldn't do, so much anger and violence that threatened the love. I was trying to be better. I focused on not wetting the bed. There were days I woke up dry, but still days that even after going to the bathroom beforehand, I woke up soaked to my neck. My baby sister was a cure at this point. Not for the bedwetting, but she was day-to-day joy because she loved me. She saw me. One day, Dolores and I were coming back from school. We neared the house and saw huge drops of blood on the pavement. Dolores whispered under her breath, "Oh my God." We got to our front steps and saw more blood, and the front window on the door broken. We walked in, and Anita and Diane looked shell-shocked. Diane was holding Danielle, whose front shirt was saturated with blood. I almost screamed, but Diane said, "She's asleep. My dad is out looking for Mom. He said he's going to kill her." He busted her head open, and she grabbed Danielle to leave, and Daddy grabbed her back. We stopped them. The blood on Danielle was my mom's. We were terrified. Finally, my dad came back pissed. The night before, I tried to stop him from beating my mama. He was still angry at me about that. "Get y'all asses out to help me look for your mama. Soon as we find her, I'm gonna kill her." Me and Dolores went out to help him look. He kept yelling at me to walk faster. Finally, he veered off to the right and told us to go to the left. Dolores was looking one way. I was looking another. I heard Dolores cry, "Viola, oh my God, look." I looked to the left, and there was my mom, in the Rexall drugstore window. Her face was totally bloodied. Her eyes were swollen shut. She had on a dirty turtleneck and pants. She was standing next to the ice cream freezer, motioning for us to come in. Dolores ran away to get my dad. I went in. People started gathering around, and I heard the ambulance siren. My mom was crying. "Viola, your dad is gonna kill me. I couldn't take it anymore." The clerk at the store, who was married to our science teacher, was leading the paramedics in and kept asking me, "What happened to her? What happened to your mom?" I couldn't speak. I looked to my mom to tell me what to say. What do I say? Do I expose our dirty secret? The paramedics tried to get my mom to the back room. My mom looked like a frightened animal or a child. She didn't want to go back there alone, and with her arms outstretched, she screamed, "Viola, come with me, don't leave me." I just stood there and couldn't move. All I saw was the paramedics mouthing, "What happened to her?" I walked out of that drugstore. People I knew from school were among those gathered outside. "Viola, was that your mom? What happened?" I couldn't tell them that my mom is more than what you're seeing. The pity and the judgment saturated their faces. I wanted to scream out, "This is my mom. My mom. She's scared, but she is a survivor. She's somebody. I love her." But nothing came out of my mouth. I froze under the traumatic weight of the scrutiny and the judgment. Once again, I had no internal weaponry. It wouldn't occur to me until much later that this moment was not just about shame, value, or protection. it was about inheritance. I was given her blood, her eyes, her survival skills, her pain. My world was a constant train of imprinting. Because of the war zone that was our home, I always felt that I had to stay home to protect Danielle. The fights were brutal, with little attention paid to a baby in the line of fire when punches or knives were thrown. Mostly we, her big sisters, just loved her. That was the best protection we could provide. After being the youngest for so long, Danielle's birth gave me a sense of responsibility. It was as if Flojo passed me the baton when I hadn't been practicing. I now had the last leg of the race to run, the clock ticking, on a journey where every other runner has 0% body fat and mine is at 40%. My shoes are untied, I can't see because I got dry eye, but I still have to run my leg of the race. My practice run was being a primary schooler who was sent home soaked with piss. Piss-soaked, I must now run holding my baby sister. I didn't have words to explain our poverty, dysfunction, trauma to Danielle, but I could hold her. I could love her, and that's it. I didn't have the tools to protect. I didn't know that I needed protection and guidance just as much as Danielle. I didn't know, nor could I admit, that I was broken. Danielle was 8 years old the summer between my first and second years of college. A weekend in the middle of the day while I was working at Brooks Drugs on Dexter Street around the block from our apartment. Someone ran in and said, "Oh my God, Viola, you've got to come. Something's happened to your little sister." I ran outside and the cops were there with my mom screaming at the top of her lungs. My mama had on my brother's sneakers and stood there crying, just shaking one fist in the air at this man who was sitting in the back of a cop car, handcuffed. With the other hand, she was holding my baby sister close to her. Danielle had been roller skating and still had her skates on. She was crying in my mom's arms. "That dirty bastard hurt my baby," my mama said. "Dirty motherfucker." Later, I found out that an older Portuguese man would frequent the corner store on Dexter Street and molest little girls who came in. Supposedly, he came to the store to buy cigarettes. However, he would hang out at the store and walk up and down the aisles, offering to give young girls money if they allowed him to touch them. Danielle and one of her young friends roller skated to the store, which was maybe a minute from our house, to get some candy. They were in the candy aisle when the old man approached Danielle, speaking in Portuguese, trying to offer her money. She didn't know what he was saying. When he touched her privacy, she freaked out, and she and her friend skated out of there fast. Her friend said, "You've got to tell your mom. You've got to tell your mom." Danielle told my mother, and my mama put on the first shoes she saw, ran down to Dexter Street and yelled, "You motherfucking son of a bitch, touch my daughter. There's a man in this store, touch my daughter. I'm going to call the police." The guys who owned the store tried to calm my mom down by saying, "Ma'am, he does that to all the little girls. It's not a big deal." My mom said, "It is a big deal, you motherfuckers," and then ran out of the store into the middle of the street, flagged down the police, and identified the old man. "That's the man. This is what he did with my daughter. I'm pressing charges." That's the point where I was summoned. The cops had arrested him. My mama was cursing him, holding crying Danielle. He didn't speak English. The only thing the court system did was fine him. My sister got $9 a month for the next few months from the man who molested her. $9 a month. That was the fine. No charges were ever pressed. Danielle was our baby. Your first instinct when you love a child is to protect her from the pain of the world and life. The most excruciating revelation is when you realize you can't. To be human is not to be God. What that man was allowed to do is destroy souls. It was hard to pick up the pieces after that. She had the mammoth task of healing. To this day, almost 40 years later, she is still figuring out how to do that. Only thing I could do was love her. And I did. And do. She is a reflection of me. Chapter 10, The Starting Block. I ain't never found no place for me to fit. Seem like all I do is start over. It ain't nothing to find no starting place in the world. You just start from where you find yourself. August Wilson. I wanted to be a great actor like Miss Tyson. I wanted to talk like an actor and train like an actor. The process and artistry of piecing together a human being completely different from you was the equivalent of being otherworldly. It also had the power to heal the broken. All that was inside me that I couldn't work out in my life, I could channel it all in my work, and no one would be the wiser. And if I was good at it, I could make a life. It was perfect. All of it was a perfect alchemy for healing, acceptance, and worthiness. Then Ron Stetson, a young actor and coach, came into my life when I was 14. Ron Stetson was my acting coach in the federally funded program Upward Bound. For 6 weeks in the summer, I would live on a college campus and take classes. Usually there were 48 students from various communities in Rhode Island and from many different backgrounds. Our classes started at 8 a.m. and ended around 5 p.m. The summer program was meant to mirror college so that we could learn how to make that transition from high school to college. The classes, living with people from different backgrounds, being on your own, we were all first-generation higher education-bound students. Our cohort was a mixed bag of college-bound kids, each with their own crosses to bear. Some had huge language barriers, others challenging family environments, and still others with absolutely horrific stories of political abuse and genocide from their respective countries. I loved Upward Bound. It gave me a jolt of perspective and grace about my family situation. Someone who spent 4 years living in a jungle or watching a parent get their head blown off by militia made my problems seem small. I know they weren't, but it introduced me to the painful truth that everyone is going through something. The evenings were free time until 8 p.m. or 8:30 p.m., so after dinner they gave us a choice of an extracurricular activity. Drama was one of them. In came Ron, who to me was the coolest, most handsome, unique, dynamic individual I had ever met. He drove a beat-up car that had no door on the passenger side. Way cool. He put a sheet of plastic in its place so you wouldn't fall out or get wet from the rain. He wore flip-flops, tank tops, and jeans. He was not only cool, he was different. He had different views of the world, people, race. He spoke his mind. In fact, all the counselors and teachers there did. They blew a hole in my world and opened up a new space that I could occupy. Ron gave me two huge gifts that changed my life. The first happened during our first day in acting class. He asked all 14 of us how many wanted to be actors. We all raised our hands. "You know you have to work fucking hard every fucking day," he said. A fourth of the hands went down, but I thought, "Wow, that is awesome." "Every day," he repeated, more hands down. "You can go on an audition every freaking day for 6 weeks and never ever get a job. You know that, right?" More hands down. My hand remained raised as if reaching for the sky. "And you're gonna get rejected time and time and time again," Ron continued. I was the only one now who had my hand up. He kept going at me. You're going to get egg on your face. You're going to fail. Your family is not going to understand what you do, and neither will most people. I kept my hand up, staring at him. When you haven't had enough to eat, when your electricity and heat are cut off, you're not afraid when someone says life is going to be hard. The fear factor was minimized for me. I already knew fear. My dreams were bigger than the fear. He stared at me. Okay, let's get back to class. The second gift Ron gave happened at our wrap party at his house. My sister Dolores, who was also in the class, was talking to me about some boy. I don't remember what exactly she was saying to me, but somewhere in there was a reference to us not being pretty. He said, "Wait, you both don't think you're pretty? Why?" We looked at each other completely embarrassed and laughed. I said, "Ron, no one in Central Falls thinks we're pretty. We've never had boyfriends. We've never kissed anyone." There was a very uncomfortable shift in the air. "What?" "Ron, most of the people in Central Falls are white, and they're just, we..." Dolores and I were at a loss for words. "You both are fucking beautiful. I always thought that. You don't see it?" The air in the room shifted again. Or was it the air in our lungs? It's that life-changing thing that happens when you're seen, valued, and adored. Adoration for girls validates our femininity. When you are a dark-skinned girl, no one simply adores you. They laugh with you, tell you their secrets, treat you like you're one of the boys. But there's no care given to you, no devotion given to you. The absence of that becomes an erasure. I learned so much from Ron that first summer of my drama training. He said, "Theater awakens the imagination." Ah, imagination. The mind's ability to create ideas and images. That's what was injected in me when Ron stated with so much conviction, "You're beautiful." It opened up another space in my world where I actually could be anyone or anything I wanted to be. I could define my world in that space and piggyback to my world stronger. Like Wonder Woman spinning and transforming into this superhuman being that could bust through lies and beat down 200-pound men. He gave me the first ingredient I needed to be an artist, the power to create, the power of alchemy, that magical process of transformation and creation to believe at any given time I could be the somebody I always wanted to be. He also gave all of us something even more special, a sacred space where we could all share without shame or fear, a space where we could share our deepest, darkest secrets, and they would be received with love and empathy. He encouraged us not to hold it in, and man, oh man, did he love it when we did anything bold, odd, unique. He would just exclaim loudly, "Fucking look at that." I became an actor because it's a healing wellspring. Upward Bound was a melting pot of races. What we shared, besides all being desperately poor, was a passion to be the first generation in our families to get an education and to be high achievers. In the evenings, when we were allowed to connect, the stories were bone-chilling. We were the blacks, whites, Cambodians, Laotians, Hmong, Vietnamese, then labeled the boat people, Angolan, African Portuguese, Dominicans, Puerto Ricans. The Southeast Asians would primarily have stories of their entire family being slaughtered and escaping to the jungle only to have to live there for months, sometimes years, before finding a refugee camp where some contracted malaria. Most had language barriers or severe health concerns, but all were exceptional students. All had a willingness to share. It was the first place I knew where Joao, Phi, Vanna, Maria, Peaches, and Susie were all on the same playing field. Suddenly, my stories of hardship seemed small. An awareness I felt God was orchestrating. I wanted my story to be small. I wanted it to shrink like a tumor down to a manageable size. Drama provided an escape. The emotional release acting aloud gave me great joy, perfect joy. When I was acting, I felt everything. Every last receptor in my body was alive, 100% alive, and I was not hiding anything. I felt free to talk about all kinds of different shit when I was in a group with other actors. That's why the most troubled students would always be put in drama class. Everybody vomits. Everybody is allowed to disclose their trauma, share their stories of horrific sexual and/or physical abuse, unmask really quirky humor, reveal their deepest, darkest secrets, everything. People listen with empathy, 100% on board, supportive. But, then you have to go out into the world as you. You move through your life trying to retain the life force you had on that stage and in that class. Whoopi Goldberg, as the medium in the movie Ghost, had a talent to channel all these souls. Some were good and some weren't. But regardless, she then had to come back to herself and her life. As an actor, you become a soul searcher, a thief. After the curtain call, you are left with you. When I went to Upward Bound, I hadn't wet the bed in over a year. I was so proud. But then, out of the blue, my first night of our 6 weeks on a college campus, I woke up and I was wet, shocked, ashamed, and said, "No one can come into this room." I didn't have a roommate, but there were suite mates, 12 little rooms in the suite. My room was probably 150, 200 square feet. I had gone to my room and proudly set it up with whatever I had, which was next to nothing. That was the last time I wet the bed. It pissed me off. I thought I had more control. My lesson from Upward Bound was, you have to open your mouth and own your freaking story. That terrified me more than rats.